I'm Iris McAlpin, and you're listening to Pure Curiosity, an exploration of the human experience and what it takes to be mentally healthy in our modern world. All right, Preston, hi, how are you?
I am absolutely amazing.
So glad to hear that. I'm really excited to talk to you. It's so funny because of all the videos that you post and everything, I kind of feel like I've hung out with you before, even though this is our first time actually talking.
Yeah, true.
So
Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you to do just a brief intro. Who are you? What do you do? What's your thing?
Yeah, well, the who am I part is pure unadulterated love. I am, you know, frequency in a space. There's a thousand ways to say it, but what I do in the world, I'll say it in two ways. One, I consider myself to be a messenger of love. When someone asked me, you know, what my purpose is, I say it's to be the living embodiment of God's love as a father, husband, and transformational teacher. Now, how that gets manifested in the world is I teach and lead trauma-based somatic workshops all around the world with my wife and also with a crew of men called Conscious Man Brotherhood. And then I also help coaches make more money and build a better coaching business. So those are the two things I'm really focused on right now. I've been considered a personal freedom coach because I believe that that's the thing that matters the most. Yeah. Yep.
I love
that's
it.
How I'm rolling. Yep.
And what you're doing is beautiful. And I'm grateful that people like you exist in the world. And I'm curious to hear how you got there, because that's not something that just happens by accident usually.
Yeah, I appreciate that. The short story is I got sick, and I got sick enough, and it was my heart, and many people in my family have died from heart failure. And so I had to figure it out really quick. And I was 25 years old at this time. I'm 40 now. And so at 25, I didn't want to die. And so I quickly started to essentially just go cold turkey on everything. And at the time, my girlfriend's mother gave me a book, and she said, "Preston, I know you're dyslexic and I know you don't like to read. However, I think this would really help you." And I was so desperate that I just took the book. And a day later, I opened it up, and it was called Ask and It Is Given by Jerry and Esther Hicks. Hmm. And it blew me away in the best and worst way possible, because it just changed everything for me. And literally the secret came out, I think, that same a few years later, and a bunch of stuff just sort of all opened up for me at the same time. And I became this I was an actor, and I was on Entourage and a bunch of commercials, and I was with Wilhelmina. I was modeling, I was doing the entertainment thing, and one day it really hit me, because people kept coming to me for coaching, and it like got around town that I had, you know, I was like this black Buddha that everybody everybody wanted to talk to. And I said, you know what? People ask me the same questions all the time. I'm going to create a YouTube channel called Questions with Preston. And literally that was the beginning of a really beautiful journey of me discovering as much of who I am I could possibly discover. I'm still on that journey, and giving that gift back to people, you know, recognizing that it's actually my duty to go back and help people up the mountain. And so that's what I've been doing ever since.
That's amazing. I'm curious to hear your take on how our generational or intergenerational experiences shape our health. It seems like when I hear heart trouble, I think pain, right? Like emotional pain.
Yep.
And I'm just curious to hear your perspective on that.
Yeah, for sure. So just to sort of break it down for you. And my dad died 7 months ago. And that was something that I had been fearing since I was 13. And so when I finally went into a cardiologist's office and you know, he ran a few tests and had me come back a few days later, and he said, you know, I'm going to give you some pills that will regulate your heartbeat for the, you know, for the rest of your life, essentially. But as a father and as a citizen, I got to tell you, your diet and your stress levels are off the charts. And the diet part, I was blown away by, because I'm like, well, I eat what's on commercials. I eat what's I eat food. And he was like, that's not food. But the stress levels part is the part that I didn't really understand. And the more I dove into it and realized, and he asked me about my life, and I sort of explained that at around 13 is when I found out that my dad was smoking crack cocaine. And all the little boys at my school made fun of me because they wanted to take me down. I was like a rich kid who had everything, and I could fight and I could play basketball and I had all the coolest clothes. And so the way that they took me down was by making fun of me and saying, calling my dad a crack addict. And while that was very hurtful and I essentially shut my heart down, the thing that was more hurtful was that I was afraid my dad was going to die. Yes. And so you take a 13-year-old and put that kind of pressure on him. And then funny enough, not funny enough, but at 15, my dad and his current wife broke up, and it was just him and I in this house. And apparently he stopped paying the mortgage and just sort of would sit on the couch all day and do drugs probably. And they came and took the house. So I came back to a boarded up, beautiful, like 4-bedroom house in this amazing neighborhood. And I remember breaking in and grabbing all my stuff and running to my mom's house, who lived around the corner, and just fearing that my dad, I didn't know where he would go. And he did. He slept on the streets. Mm. And I think that level of stress on a 17-year-old and a 15-year-old and a 22-year-old, by the time I was 25, my heart was so, I was so stressed out from thinking that I need to make it so that I can send my dad to a recovery place or something like that, that it jacked me up. And, you know, I do believe that we can be above the genetic code or whatever you want to call it. I think it's called epigenetics, because I'm living proof of it. You know, like I look younger now at 40 than I did at 25.
That's amazing.
And it's not just looks though. Like I have I do blood tests. I biohack. Last night I did a vitamin IV therapy for an hour. So like,
How is that? I haven't tried that yet.
It's the best thing ever. Like I have more energy now than I did at freaking 18.
Huh, that's crazy.
Yep.
I need some of that.
yeah, for sure.
Thank you for sharing that. How did you start to turn that stress around? Because that's not just job stress. That's like deeply embedded stress.
For sure. It's trauma.
Trauma.
Like I had so many traumas. Traumas on top of traumas.
Which our nervous system registers as the same, as I'm sure you know.
Exactly. Exactly. And, it, you know, I'm sure you teach this as well. The body's a living library and it stores mm-hmm. everything we've ever been through. And so I had so many things. I mean, so many things. I also joined a gang. I also had many of my friends get shot and killed. And I've lived quite an extensive life, and all of that stuff. I never cried. Like that 10-year-old didn't cry. The 13-year-old didn't cry. The 17-year-old didn't cry. At the funeral of my friend who was shot in the face, I did not cry. And so all of that was just stuck in my body. And when I recognized that I didn't want to die, I began to seek support and go to as many workshops and counseling and coaches and everything I could get my hands on. And I read every single book I could. And it was conversations with God that really opened everything up for me. And I began to support those same workshops, and quickly realized that I was like, I wouldn't say better than the trainer, but I was getting pretty epic results for the people coming into my space. And it's because they knew I had lived it. It wasn't that I was just theorizing how to get out of this stuff, how to get out of a dark hole. I had lived it and was living it in those moments. And it's been quite the journey.
That's the most powerful thing there is, I think. When somebody is coming at it, I mean, there's value to coming at these topics from a purely intellectual standpoint. It's better than not addressing it at all. Well, but when you can actually speak to it from experience and people are watching that transformation in front of their eyes, you just can't beat that. And I am curious, you said that you found this book and that it started opening things up for you. And I'm interested to hear what that process was like for you, because I would imagine it's sort of like a dam breaking, but I'd be curious to hear you explain that.
Yes, that's exactly how it felt too. Yeah. I don't know if you've ever read a book and just like had the stank face when you were reading it. Like I was, or like, you know how you hear like a really good song and you make that ugly face and you're like, oh, this is just so good. Like I would be reading Conversations with God, and I literally can quote so much of that book. I've read it 100 times. I'll never forget this moment. So there was and I forget what page it's on, but God said to Neil Donald Walsh, you cannot have what you want, but you may experience what you have. And that just blew me to pieces. And I had, I'm experiencing the tail end of dyslexia. And so because of that, I read a lot slower than most people. And because of that, I retain information and allow it to penetrate and permeate my body more than most people do, because I'm not speeding through. I'm actually letting it land. And that quote, I literally for months just sat with that and was like, how can I apply this to my life? I cannot have what I want, but I may experience what I have. That just like opened up a whole can of worms. And I would do that. I would take a paragraph and say, okay, for the next 3 weeks, I'm just going to try this on. I'm going to see how it feels in my space, in my world. I'm going to see how I can apply this to my everyday interactions. And it was like exponential. Like my growth just started. It was like I was leapfrogging into dimensions that I didn't know was possible. And I still do it to this day. I don't read fast. I read to let it land.
Are you by any chance a Vipassana meditator?
I haven't. That's the one thing I haven't done yet that I do want to do.
Well, it's just interesting because what you're describing is essentially that. Vipassana is all about being with your felt experience, whatever that looks like in the moment, good, bad, ugly, you know, and just focusing. It's really an experience of intense focus on what's happening in the present and bringing equanimity to that experience. And that's exactly what you're doing as you're reading. It sounds like you're focusing your mind and you're feeling into what's in your body. So you kind of organically discovered that.
Yeah, that's trippy. Yeah, everybody I know who's ever done Vipassana says amazing things about it. And it is on my list.
You'll love it. It'll probably feel like the water you swim in many ways already.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm definitely excited to take that journey.
And so after this proverbial dam broke and you were, you know, feeling into your experience and really focusing in on this text that really struck you, how did the steps look? You know, you were living this entertainment life, you're modeling, you're acting, and now obviously your life looks radically different. So how did that happen?
Over time, for sure.
Sure, yeah.
I'll never forget it. I had a friend over, and he's a director of a movie that I was going to be shooting. And he was looking around my house, and he was picking up books. And he was like, don't you find it interesting that all of your time, all of your energy is going towards like this sort of self-development, spirituality, personal development, transformation space, but that you're calling yourself an actor? Hmm. And it just like hit me like, yeah, that is interesting. Why am I doing that? And I sat in the question and I recognized that I had a limiting belief that the only way to truly affect big positive change was to go down the entertainment route because I could get to more people. So I was only acting so I could do what I'm doing now. And, you know, people are afraid of numbers and things like that. But for the last few years, I've done more than $1 million. And that, I couldn't fathom that at 28. I couldn't even receive that that was possible at 29. And so the process looked like me dropping all of my agencies and all of the things that I was sort of tethered to. And I created a, I asked myself this question, and I dare anybody listening to ask themselves the same question, knowing that I have the direction, right? Because direction is much more important than speed, right? I have the direction. I know I'm going towards this thing called transformation, personal development, thought leadership, but I am not ready. I knew I wasn't ready, right? There's a whole, which is a whole other lesson in itself. A lot of people are asking for big lives, but they haven't built the somatic body that can hold what they say they want. And so I knew I didn't, I couldn't hold that. And so what I did was I joined this like team of motivational speakers, and I started learning that, that route. And I was doing free talks and speeches at high schools and colleges and junior highs. And I asked myself this question, which was, what can I do that soon that can make me money, but that will still be in alignment with where I'm headed? And literally, it hit me like a ton of bricks. Preston, you surf all the time. Hmm. You've taught people to surf hundreds of times for free. Why don't you create a surf school, a spiritual surf school, where you use psychology and coaching methods to help people learn how to surf in 30 minutes or less?
And wow. I need to like, do that.
Yeah. And it was like, boom, there it is. And funny enough, you know, and not funny, when, because we're threefold beings, right? Body, mind, and soul, or however you want to see it that way. And when those three things are in alignment, we are at our most powerful. And so my mind was clear, my body was a fuck yes, and my soul was like, yes, bro, this is what you do. Like, let's get it. And so all those things lined up, and I put it out into the universe and instantly got a bunch of people that said, oh, I would love it, I would love it, I would love it. And put up a website, went on like Living Social and some of those Groupon things, and sold like 100 in like an hour. And like, it just went crazy. And ended up hiring other instructors and literally had a business. Like, I was successful. I was probably the most successful surf school that particular year in the LA area. And it was because I had a new twist on it. I created a niche out of something that was normal for regular people. And Iris, I really want to nail this home for people, because I believe what I was doing then is the same thing I'm doing now, which is why I'm successful. I'm going to just give you a little backstory. So surf schools do their best to not fully serve people so that they can extend it and get 3 to 4 lessons out of those people. So that's like the industry standard. Don't actually show them how to fully surf, because if you do, they won't hire you for another lesson, and therefore you don't get as much money. And so I knew that they were doing that, and decided that I was going to serve people in 30 minutes or less, get videos and pictures of it, and actually help them. Mm-hmm. And what ended up happening was those people kept sending me people.
Yeah, exactly. It's the same in coaching and therapy.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's crazy to me. I have people come to me and say, you know, I've been seeing this therapist for 5 years. And I'm like, what is going on that this person can't deliver what you're looking for in 5 years? To me, that just seems unethical.
Deeply. Deeply. But people don't know any better. They think that that's how it's supposed to be, which is, you know, I help coaches all the time. And sometimes they'll say to me, and no offense to anybody, even yourself, if you do this, but they'll say, oh, yeah, my package is this much, and I offer coaching every single week. And X, Y, and Z. And I explained to them that that's a therapy model. Like, the reason why I don't particularly ever coach people every single week is because if I do, I become their God. And I don't want to be their God. I want them to learn how to walk on their own. And so I keep just enough distance from them so that they can actually fall, get back up, fall, get back up. And then in between that week, learn some stuff, apply some of the stuff we did. And then when we have our session, we can talk about it. And, you know, that's just my theory. It doesn't have to be, you know, true or facts, but like, I think that a lot of even the coaching industry is taking like a page from the therapy industry, and not therapy is amazing.
Yeah.
It's like, it's awesome. Like, I think it's deeply needed. All of it's needed, but coaching and therapy are not the same things. And I think that distinction really needs to be nailed home, because a coach's job is to actually get that person results sooner rather than later. And in a therapy model, just based on how the government has set it up, it needs to be this extended thing, and where, you know, it doesn't have much of you in it. And, you know, I've coached and helped a lot of therapists who are like, hey, all that we've been taught is to stay out of it.
Yeah.
To not even have a freaking Facebook or anything. And I'm like, well, that's beautiful for that, but we also need to evolve. And so
I think we need both. Yeah. Cause it is nice to have this completely neutral person to go to with certain things, but we also need people showing their deepest, darkest wounds and how they move through them and how they live their lives and how they're relating to current events and all of these things. I think we desperately need both. And I also feel like, you know, because people live in a scarcity mindset, there's a feeling of, you know, if I help people too quickly, then I'll lose my business. I have to like hold some of my secret sauce back, because if I don't, you know, they're gonna leave. But then, like, exactly like you said, they send other people, and you know, there's so many people struggling out there. It's not like we're gonna run out. I hate to say that, but unfortunately, truth. It's the truth. Yeah,
truth. So much truth.
So I'm curious to hear, you cover so many topics on your videos, which I appreciate, because a lot of coaches feel like they have to like stick to their lane or whatever. And you're just like, I don't have a lane. I'm going to, or maybe that's not true, but it seems like, you know, you just kind of go there if that's what you're feeling.
Yep.
And so what is something that is really, really interesting to you right now?
There's a few things, but I'll say this. I do have a lane. My lane is called human.
Yeah.
And this idea that we're one dimensional or one tracked is like, I get it from like a business perspective. Like, you want to be known for something. And there's, you know, I teach my coaches all the time. There's two different paths here. You could be a coach who makes a beautiful living and like supports and has a huge impact, or you could be a thought leader who coaches. And those are not the same thing.
Yeah.
They are definitely not the same thing. I started as just a coach who was making a beautiful living, who, you know, didn't necessarily want to be at the top of the mountain. And then I realized that a part of my job on this planet is to be a beacon, is to be something that people can see and go, ah, that, my version of that, to be a permission slip for people to be their most authentic selves. And so my way of operating in the planet has to do with that understanding as well. And my willingness to give people an opportunity to hear a different perspective. With that said, I think I'm most interested right now in relationship stuff is always juicy for me.
Yeah. There's so much contained in that. It's like a universe into itself.
Yes, it is. It's so, and specifically, because a lot of women don't get to hear from men, right? They hear from the men they're arguing with. They hear from men. But they don't really understand us, per se. And because I work with men and I have Conscious Man Brotherhood and I work with a bunch of women, I get to hear both sides. And I'm studying all of this stuff and studying what happens within me and my nervous system and, you know, really like dropping in. And so I feel like it's so interesting, and it's my duty to sort of help women and men understand that we're not the same species, and that's okay. And that it's awesome. and amazing and fun and interesting and polarizing, and all of those things are okay and perfect.
Do you ever listen to Alison Armstrong, or are you familiar with her at all?
I am. She's freaking awesome.
I love her. But yeah, she's always like, men are not just hairy women. You know, they're very, very different. And that learning about that has definitely saved me. I'm curious to hear what some of the biggest themes you notice with your clients that come up in relationships.
Yeah. So I was coaching last night in a group called Integrate. That's a behind the scenes private group that has to, that goes, from, comes from my workshops. And three different women on that call brought up a very similar thing. One person brought it up, which she said, you know, my question is like, how do I get my man to be his word, because he's not being his word, and X, Y, and Z, right? And
so right.
She continues, and I explained to her that everybody has a hidden dream inside of their ideas about relationship. And one of the biggest issues that can happen is you can unconsciously punish your partner for not fulfilling that dream in the now moment. And so she had this dream, and he said it to her. He did. He said, I want to meditate together and X, Y, and Z, right? And he went and did my workshop and did a program I had after, because she sent him there. And he actually loved it and stuck on with us and all the things. But he wasn't meditating with her. And so she took this as he's not being his word. And so what I helped her understand and look at was, you know, the age-old adage, what you focus on expands,
yeah.
Right? So let's focus on all the ways he is being his word, one. Two, I helped her see that there are cycles and seasons in life, right? We understand this when it comes to the seasons, but we don't understand it when it comes to the development of men. And I call it the slinky effect, right? So like there's some seasons you're going to be way up and some seasons you're going to be way down. And that's the job of your partner, is to still be there with you, loving on you, holding you, and holding the fort down without punishing you for being down or being up. And in that moment, what she was doing was punishing him for not being where she is in this moment. And I shared with him that in my, I think almost 15 years of being in this work, I find it more important that a man has other men friends who are conscious than a man who's meditating or reading books. Because
oh, that's interesting.
him having a court, if you may, a crew of men to hold him accountable, to me is way more important than him doing the sort of excuse me, top layer sort of things that look like he's conscious.
That makes so much sense. It's like the people who dress spiritually but don't have
yes.
a spiritual practice, you know? It's like, that's not going to work out. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
For sure. Because, you know, men, we all, for the most part, if we grew up in a Western culture, have been conditioned, let's call it nature and nurture, to compete. And so even in my workshops, I put so many spaces in there for the groups to compete with each other, because I know they'll rise to the occasion. There's an aspect of all of us when that testosterone kicks in and that single focus, gotta win, gotta win, gotta win. When that kicks in, guys will rise to the occasion. And so if a guy has other men like that who are saying, yo, bro, go back. Go tell her you love her. You know she needs a hug right now. Walk back in that room. If a guy has that, he's 10 times better than if he has a book by Deepak Chopra. Because that won't make the difference. What makes the difference is having community and accountability from conscious men.
I love hearing that, because that, I think, is one of the most important things. I think we all need that, but I very much see what you're saying, that it's especially critical with men. Because otherwise it just all exists in theory, and having that community is kind of where the rubber meets the road.
Yes, yes, yes. 1,000%. And yes, women is needed as well. You guys have been better at that.
Yeah, exactly.
I was explaining to the girls, I said, if you want to hack your man, if you want to like win in man world, praise him more than you think is comfortable. Like, because we do, we literally do. And I know Allison talks about this. We do things for points. And so yeah. if you praise us for the small things, we're going to want to do the bigger things, and we're going to want to do more of the small things as well. And so, you know, it seems counterintuitive, because a lot of times, because women, let's say the cave woman within you guys is diffused focus, you're seeing all the ways in which we're not, all the things that are not working, all the, and that becomes, you know, all encompassing. And for men, we do not, ladies, if you're listening, let this land. We do not get praised by our friends. We don't get praised by people at work. We don't get praised if we have kids by them. And so you're the last line of defense. If we're not receiving and feeling loved by you, if when we hear from you, it's about what we're not doing and who we're not being, oh, that's going to be a problem. It's definitely going to be a problem.
I'm so glad you said that, because it really is one of the most important things in relationship happiness. I think when you're dealing with a man and a woman together. And I think because a lot of us were raised with this critical discipline model, we think that that's the way to create change. And, you know, women often respond to criticism. If we're criticized, we're like, oh shit, I better like get myself in line. But men don't respond that way. And so we're just making them sad. You know, we're not actually getting them any, or mad. We're not getting them anywhere yes. closer to where we want. And I think it's tough, because again, I think it can be sort of a scarcity mentality that contributes to this, where, you know, women have this beautiful, soft, creative, deeply powerful energy that men want to be around, and we can be kind of stingy with it sometimes.
Yes, 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 yes. So true. It's so good. You guys have a power that we don't, and we know it, and you guys know it, and all it takes and this may piss you off, Iris, and I said it last night, and the girls, the people I said it to, it was like, I think it was 25 women and 2 guys. So I knew I was setting myself up for the pissed at me. But there's this meme, and I don't know if you've ever seen it, where it says woman, and then it's like the colon, then it says apologize or die. And then under it, it says person. And it's talking to a woman. Apologize or die, and then under it is a woman in a casket smiling, and the accuracy of that is so freaking crazy, because if you ask guys, you really want to know, I'm behind the scenes with these guys, you know what they all say? They're like, bro, even when she's wrong, I still have to take the L, even when she's absolutely 100% not right about something, because if I make sure that she knows that, she's going to punish me. Mm-hmm. I'm getting punished no matter what. And I think that one of the best things, and this is global, this is not the case for everyone. However, there are some universal themes, because we all grew up to the same Disney stuff, and the same, we are all nurtured very similarly from television and film, etc. One of the best things you could do as a woman, because he knows, right? It's usually him getting in trouble for something he did. If he liked a picture on Instagram, if he freaking didn't take the trash out fast enough, what if he, you know, isn't meditating when you think he should, whatever the case may be, he's 9 out of 10, those arguments, the things that come up, are coming from your end. And so just every once in a while, the power of just being like, baby, I'm so sorry. Like, you know, hormonally, whatever it is, I wasn't in my right space. And like just owning that every once in a while, that would do the biggest difference for a guy, because they legitimately believe that you guys don't think that you're ever wrong,
yeah.
like ever. And I know Yeah,
I'm
I'll
not
leave that.
offended by that at all, but I love that you're saying that because I think it opens up a kind of more nuanced point, which is apology in general. Again, I think a lot of the ways that we're socialized is almost like, at least I can speak for myself, in my childhood home, apologizing was an admission of guilt and
Yes.
then opened me up for further
Yes.
criticism and punishment. And so it was like, if I apologize, that's like a threatening experience. And so I'm gonna stick to my guns and be right at all costs.
Yes.
Otherwise, I'm toast, right? And
Yes.
so it took me so much freaking coaching and work to get to a place where I could actually say I'm sorry. And it still feels threatening sometimes in the
Yes.
moment, depending on, what the situation is. But it's the most important thing in a relationship, I think, because if we're making our men feel, or our partners, whatever, feel like they're always at fault, that builds a ton of resentment.
Yes, a ton.
And it just like leaves bitterness in the relationship. And so if we can't do the work it takes, and I acknowledge it can feel scary as hell to apologize, but it's essential. And so I'm glad that you brought that up. And I think women are particularly, afraid of it. Even if they wouldn't articulate it that way, I think we are afraid.
Yeah, it's one of those things that it can, because some women will say, well, or people will say, well, I did apologize. And what I want to bring up is the nuances of like a backhanded apology,
Oh, yeah.
right? Like, because it happens so much where you're like, I am sorry that you thought that about me, because what really happened was that you were just being an asshole. And, I'm just like,
It's
pretty
like,
sure
I'm
that.
sorry for telling my truth or whatever. That's
Yes,
kind of,
yes, yes. That stuff is so funny, because a guy will see it and be like, okay, I have two choices here. I can either call this out, which is, I know it's bullshit, or I can just take it for what it is. And a lot of times they just like let it be, and it turns into resentment. And I was coaching a guy, through text, actually, who's in one of my groups yesterday, who's been married for 15 years. And he was saying, this is it, where, I'm going to get an apartment in the next couple of days. And I was trying to help him see that if that's going to be the case, because I don't necessarily believe in forever. I believe in for however long it needs to be for people to, have the journey they came to have. But I said, if you're going to do that, do it from love. If you guys are going to separate, separate at the highest heights of joy. And as the leader of your household, I challenge you to in this moment, because I get you already did it, but in this moment, stop taking her weather as personal. It's just weather, right? You're the sky. Hold the weather, and don't take it personal, because that's what happens, guys. After a while, it just builds up, builds up, builds up, builds up, and then it becomes personal. And people, this is not guys or women. People, all of us do this. We unconsciously take character shots at our partners, right? I think you know this work. The Gottmans talk about a complaint versus a criticism. And a lot of times, what someone believes is a complaint is actually a criticism about someone's character. And you can only take so much of that before it sort of implodes on itself. And so I was trying to help him see that all her shots at his character, she didn't know she was personally doing that. And he was taking it deeply personal. And we delete, distort, and generalize, right? So the idea is we have these perfect memories that can like understand everything, and the reality is that that's complete BS. When we're block thinking, and once we get locked in on an idea, we go back and we rewrite history. Because he was trying to tell me, well, she's this and she's that and she's this, and I was like, bro, no, she's not. She's some of those things some of the times. But what's happening right now is your brain is going back and deleting and distorting and generalizing things to see it through a particular lens called she's a raging bitch and you need to divorce her.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an interesting thing. I feel like women have also internalized some of the toxic masculine culture in the sense that we feel like, oh, he's a man, he should be able to take it.
Yes.
If I dish this out.
Yes. Oh my God.
And it's kind of fucked up because we're burdening men with our opinions and our criticisms, and that adds up over time, and it really can be devastating to the person for one, but also devastating to the relationship.
1000%. I know that I've been at the receiving end of that and not been forthright with sharing how much my feelings were hurt, and just internalizing it. You know, men are leading every single category besides breast and ovaries as far as disease. Everyone, like literally everyone besides breast and ovaries. And to me, the reason for that is the internalizing of all of the pain and the shame and the guilt that they've held and not really understanding how to be with that powerfully, and feeling like they're in a catch-22. Right, like our job, you know, I have, and I'm gonna slightly switch the subject, but not like fully. I've had these feminist groups like attack me every once in a while.
Yeah.
And you know, it's all good. I welcome it to a degree. I don't like attack, but I get that they have a different viewpoint, and I get that I'm also very polarizing. And one of the things that, I try to help people see is the very things that we're sort of pointing at about men and toxic masculinity are very similar to the things that are being enacted at us, towards us.
Yeah.
In the finger pointing.
I see that too.
So like, for instance, there's a group and they have a huge group and they, every once in a while they attack me because I say, not everybody's ex-boyfriend is a narcissist.
Okay? Yeah,
like, it's just not true. Like you can't, like your ex-husband isn't a narcissist. You, if he is, then you are too, right? Like everybody's diagnosing every dude they've ever dated with narcissism. And it's freaking trendy and it's whack that they do that because when I coach women, sometimes I eviscerate them. Not because I don't like them, because I want them to see, and I help them, and this is all from love, that the very like psychological things that they're doing to their partner is the shit that like they're blaming their partner for.
Yeah.
That we're in this together. Legit, we're all in this together. I think we forget that. It becomes a man versus woman thing. And if, excuse me, anybody who's listening, if you hear in my space that I think that, because I don't. I love women, and we need you guys. We absolutely do. I'm telling you, I see the biggest, buffest, blubbering babies. I see these guys, they come in my room and they are deeply, deeply traumatized. And they've been holding it together. They're dentists, they're accountants, they're lawyers, they're freaking police officers. They are deeply wounded. And we need you guys. We need you like no other. So I just want to like really let that like sit in here because I think that it can get so easy. It could become this us versus them thing.
It's the same as our political climate. I mean, we're in, our fate is bound together as a country.
Yes.
And we're like wanting to, you know, wipe the other party off the map. And it's so toxic. And I see it in relationship dynamics and male, female, feminist, anti-feminist, whatever. And it's troubling to me because I do. I mean, I'm as somebody who's experienced a lot of sexual trauma and sexual assault, like I get the women's side of it. And I also believe that all of these things are intimately tied. It's not like women are only the victims. Men are also victims. And if we're without condoning or supporting or anything, what some men are doing to women, I see the complexity of it, and it's just not as simple as like men are pigs or men are idiots or men are brutes or whatever people are saying. And a lot of times men turn into assholes because their moms abuse them, or, you know, some woman like stomped on their heart. And it's obviously more like, that's a massive oversimplification, right? Like there are so many different factors that lead to a person doing what they do, but it's part of the picture. And I just don't think we can ignore that. And so I believe that we all need to be doing the healing work. Nobody is exempt. And yes, there are certain people that are, you know, weaker and more vulnerable and need to be protected. And like, I'm a huge advocate for that, or people that are, you know, discriminated against or oppressed. All of that is extremely, extremely important to include in that complex conversation. But I do feel like the black and white thinking really doesn't help at all.
No, totally. Totally. And there's something you said that I really want to like drill in on. I've been leading workshops for almost 7 years. And if there's 100 people in the room, which we don't, we've done that before, but we don't usually do it. If there's 100 people in the room, 85 of them have been sexually abused. And that's men and women. Now, in the men's workshops that I do, there's an exercise, a thing where we say step forward, step in the circle if, right? And inevitably I'll say step in the circle if you've been sexually abused before the age of 13. 98% of the room steps forward.
Wow.
Okay? I say stay in the circle if it was by a woman. Half of that room stays there.
Interesting.
So it's like, okay, for instance, and I'm jumping around, but like statistically women cheat more than men do.
Yeah, I have read that statistic.
However, the way that it's painted in society is that men are these, they think with their dick, they X, Y, and Z. Like, bro, are you kidding me? Like the actual numbers support that that's not true. So, and I teach and I talk about how we all had well-meaning mothers, right? Because if we really want to talk about toxic masculinity, who raised all these toxic men? Who raised them? Moms, well-meaning moms who did what? It's the same thing my mom tried to do, which is beat all of the things she hated about my dad out of me. And in doing so, she wounded me. She made me think and believe that when women are around, that I'm on duty. I can't be me. I can't be me because I'm on duty. I got to protect the woman. I got to be here for. So guess what happened? By the time I was 10 years old, I equated women with the opposite of freedom. So I didn't want to ever be around girls or women, because if that meant that I had to walk on a certain side of the street and do X, Y, and Z, which she called training me to be a gentleman, but in unconsciously it trained me that I was not allowed, my life didn't even matter as much as a woman's life. I need to die before her if we're walking down the street, right? And now my mom meant so well, and she's freaking awesome and such a loving, beautiful woman, but I don't think she's special. I think that she's, a lot of moms did that and do that.
Yeah, they do.
And it's our job. You know, I think that's what you're up to, Iris, and what I'm up to is helping people come back to their truth, back to their hearts, back to understanding who and what they really are, which is also an animal, which is also complex and beautiful and deep. And gender roles in our society have gotten sort of mashed up, and we're trying to figure it out. You know, we're in this process. We're all figuring it out.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear that. So much of the abuse happens from women, because you're right, you don't hear about that.
Nope, guys don't talk.
And what you're talking about with, you know, the well-meaning mothers essentially traumatizing their sons, you know, telling them that who you are is not enough and that you need to sacrifice your life for somebody else because you're expendable is kind of the message.
Yep.
People don't think about the impact of that. Because we impose our adult logic onto children's minds and think that they should understand the complexities of this that I understand, which they don't, because nobody's taught them yet. They haven't lived enough life to necessarily understand all of the different factors. And so I think it's important that we talk about it compassionately, which you are. Like, your mom meant the best. She wanted you to be a good boy, you know. There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
And there's an impact.
Yep.
And for sure. So for men listening, I'm curious how you go about addressing starting to open this door of being vulnerable with men and sharing themselves. Because I do feel like, as much as women want sensitive men, we often unconsciously, you know, we're not necessarily doing it intentionally, but we emasculate men when they show their sensitive side. And so that's something to be mindful of for the women. If your man is being sensitive with you, like, praise the heck out of him and don't, you know, try to shut it down. But for the men, how do you begin opening that door with them?
Yeah, I mean, I'll say this. I have sort of an unfair advantage because of social media. So when we do these workshops, most of these guys, they never heard of me. Because a lot of times, wives and girlfriends will send the link and be like, you're going to this. Right? But when they see what we're doing, and then they do even just a little bit of research about me, what tends to happen, because I grew up in a neighborhood with like 30 boys, is there's an aspect, even though I'm eccentric and I dress weird and all the other things, there's an aspect of them that goes, oh, I know that guy. Mm. Like I can, you know, and if they go down the rabbit hole and watch some of my stuff, they're going to hear that I'm an advocate for all of us, including them. And not many people speak for men, right? We speak loud about how jacked up they are, but not loud about how beautiful they are. And so I can't tell you all my secrets, but I will say that we start with the deepest, heaviest stuff we possibly can every workshop. So we go straight to the gusto. So we set the tone for how this weekend is going to be. Straight to the deepest, darkest secret, straight to the thing you hold the most shame and guilt around. And that instantly, it's like going to war with, you know, a band of brothers. It instantly connects us all. And most important part, I always go first.
Yeah. That permission slip like you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yep, for sure. And let me just tell you this. I tell my men, and I believe this, and it's the same for me, not everything is your woman's business. So you're still an autonomous being. And you're in a relationship, but you don't belong to her, just like she doesn't belong to you. And so some things you take to your boys. Because if you dump on your woman, she's going to have to fill up the masculine. If you do that for too long, the polarity, the attraction will go away. And so, yes, I encourage them to be sensitive and share their feelings. And more than that, I encourage them to share it with their brothers. Right? I do the same thing. When shit's going down in my house and I'm, you know, lost. First of all, I have a coach, John Wineland, who you may have heard of, who I'll go to him. I have a whole like crew of guys that we go there, and it's not like it's like a bitch fest about our wives and stuff like that. It's like, yo, okay, well, what do you think she's thinking?
Yeah.
How do you think she feels? You know, is this a pattern? And we call each other out and forward. And I think that's the most important thing is a guy has other guys that he can help, that they can hold some of the load with him.
That's so important. And it's true, again, on both sides, because I feel like, and we all do this, I think, because we've gotten, I think, collectively more isolated, we expect so much more from our partners. It's like, they have to be our best friend and our therapist and our like, business consultant and, you know, our person that we vent to and the person that we, you know, uses a sounding board and everything. And it's not really fair to expect that from one person. And there are a lot of things that for women, we've got to go to our girlfriends for that our husband doesn't need to know about. It's just not his job to consult you on your nails or whatever. But a lot of women expect that, it's like he needs to be everything, and it just doesn't work out well.
Nope, it doesn't, because he won't ever be.
Yeah.
Right? And I don't pretend to be, I'm a flavor of the masculine, but I'm not the whole damn thing. So if my wife, needs to have a friend who's, which she does, who's like more sensitive and intellectual than me, freaking go for it. That's not how I roll. And yes, I have aspects of myself that are like that, but I'm one flavor of a beautiful bag of Skittles that will never eat vegan Skittles.
One thing that I sort of have maybe a controversial opinion on that I don't really talk about is that your jealousy is not your partner's responsibility.
Correct. True.
And of course, if your partner is like abusing that and actively trying to do things to make you jealous, that's a whole other issue. But a lot of people end up putting such strict parameters around their partner's behavior to try to control their own jealousy. And to me, that seems very unfair.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's a thing for sure. And, I liken it to, and we talk about how everybody comes into a relationship with a backpack full of hurts and wounds and stories and all the things. And a lot of times what we'll do is when something gets activated, we'll go into that bag and we'll say, oh, look, you caused this. When the reality is we walked in with it. And so I completely agree with you. Jealousy, because there's a difference between being jealous and being envious.
Yeah.
Right? I don't think that jealousy has I wouldn't call it a positive effect. Envy does, right? I envy some people and some people's relationships, et cetera, et cetera. And all it does is make me want to be better, a better version of myself. But yeah, the whole jealousy thing, because a lot comes up with like Instagram and things like that, where people get have all their stuff come up for them, which we are, from a biological standpoint, when you're with somebody for I think it's more than 2 months, your nervous systems sort of start overlapping, right? So in that way, in that sense, I am responsible for Alexi, and whoever's listening, you are responsible for your partner's nervous system, right? And we want to guard and protect that like it's our own. And there comes a point where you need to allow them to do their own work. And some people have sort of strict standards based on wounds and people who cheated on them and left them and X, Y, and Z, and anything that smells like it, looks like it, gets sort of lumped into this category of you're going to leave me.
Yeah.
And I think that that's more important to address than the actual, like, you liked her picture kind of deal.
Absolutely. Yeah. Because, of course, the jealousy often doesn't come out of thin air.
No.
There's a reason for it. And it's something that I certainly have had to deal with after being cheated on in the past and all of these kinds of things.
Yep.
But I think it's sort of a smokescreen in a way for these deeper issues.
Yes, exactly. It's like a portal for what's really below the whole thing.
Right. Yeah. And I love when I feel jealous or envious, because it tells me, oh, wow, okay, that's something I value. Like, how can I incorporate that into my life?
Yep. No, and for sure.
It's a missed opportunity, I think, a lot of times.
Can I ask how young you are?
Yeah, I'm 34.
34. Dope. Yeah, you're quite mature for 34.
Thank you. It's like that meme. It's like, oh, you're very mature for your age. It's like, thanks, it was the trauma.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it really does some wonders in a way.
I see you went to the last Burning Man.
I did. Yeah. Yeah, it was, 7 in a row for me. I'm going to take a year off this time. I always say that and I never do, but I think I'm going to be in a like training program, so I'm really going to take a year off. Do you burn? I think I saw pictures of you.
Yep, 9 years in a row, but
Oh,
I'm gonna take this year off.
wow. Are you the same as me, where it's like, yeah, maybe not gonna go back, and then it always happens?
Exactly. We have twins on the way, though. I think that
That's
it's not going to
right.
be as easy to go to Burning Man with twins and a 2-year-old. So,
Have you taken your 2-year-old?
no,
Okay.
we won't take him until he could ride a bike and
That's a good idea.
really tell us what's going on.
My whole thing is I'll take, we don't have kids yet. We're kind of working on it, but when they can understand, don't take down your dust mask and like leave
Yes.
your goggles on in a dust storm. When they're old enough to do that, then I'll feel comfortable.
Yep. 1,000%. 1,000%.
Well, thank you so much. We are like right at an hour, and this was great. I feel like we covered quite a number of topics, and I'm appreciative to hear your perspective on these relationship dynamics and male-female dynamics, because I don't get to talk about it that much, and it's something that I really love. So it was a treat to go there with you.
Absolutely. Yeah, this was fun, and I love talking to people who are like deeply entrenched in the work because we can just go into like the little nuances and things like that. And so
Exactly.
it's good.
Yeah. Awesome. All right.